It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. A day-long conference on urban education is being held this week on the Duquesne University campus. The keynote speaker is Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings, whose research and books focus on race theory and education, specifically looking at best practices for teachers with African-American students. Dr. Ladson Billings was the chair of the Department of Curriculum and Instruction. She holds the Kellner Family Endowed Professorship in Urban Education and is faculty affiliate in the Departments of Educational Policy Studies and Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin. She's the author of critically acclaimed books, including The Dream Keepers, Successful Teachers of African-American Children. Gloria Ladson Billings, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
You're a proponent of culturally relevant teaching. Explain what this is and how it can benefit students.
Okay, so about 25 years ago, I began researching teachers who were successful with African American students. And I began to see some qualities among these teachers that they held in common. I had to somehow distill them down to be able to talk to people about what's going on in these classrooms. What are these teachers actually doing? And so it's been distilled down to three main things. First of all, these teachers have a laser-like focus on student learning. For them, it is very important that kids are achieving and doing well academically. The second component is what I call cultural competence. That is, they help kids understand that they do come to school with knowledge, and they do come to school with culture, and they do come to school with histories and languages and heritages. So they have to understand they have those and they are of value, but at the same time, they have to acquire fluency in at least one other culture. So typically when we're thinking of black or brown children, we're thinking of helping them acquire fluency in, quote, mainstream culture. But that doesn't let mainstream white or middle-class kids off the hook either. They come with a culture. But they also need to learn how to be bicultural. They need to learn other languages. They need to know the histories and the customs of other groups. Then that third component is what I would call developing a socio-political consciousness. In kind of plain English, it's what kids might call the so what question. Kids ask all the time, why do we have to know this? And our typical response is a bad one because it goes something like, you're going to need this one day. And as I said earlier today to the group, by fourth or fifth grade, kids know we're lying. They're never going to need some of this stuff. But we ought to be able to have kids understand that what they learn in school could be useful for solving real problems, for grappling with real issues. I think about the fact that the country is simmering with issues around police interactions with the African American community. And kids have questions about this. Why is this happening? What can we do? Well, their skills in reading, in mathematics, in history, all can be applied to looking at these problems. Mathematics, let's look at statistics. What's been going on over time? Reading, what can we read and whose stories can we hear? A history, the fact that we have an eruption in Baltimore that really is in some ways linked to an eruption that occurred there in 1968. So almost 50 years have transpired, and we haven't done very much to improve the quality of life in certain communities.
When it comes to cultural relevance and explaining to children why something is relevant to them, someone might say, why do we owe children that explanation? Years ago, a rhetorical answer from a teacher might have gone something like, you need to know this because I'm telling you, you need to know it. So why would a child of any race be owed an explanation?
Well, I would say because the stakes are so much higher. When I graduated from high school in the mid-1960s, much of my class did not go on to college, but they were able to go on to gainful employment, employment good enough that allowed them to buy homes and lead successful lives in the community. Those options are not there anymore. And so where before, do what I say, not as I do, seemed to be the mantra, if you lost, quote, half the class, it wasn't a big deal because they had other options. But now we don't have those options. Our kids are going to need some post-secondary options in terms of going to school, whether it is a 2-year school, a 4-year school, a trade school, or vocational school. And so we can't afford for kids not to be engaged because they have to continue with their schooling.
Explain the use of your term hip-hop genius, i.e. not just bringing hip-hop music into the classroom.
One of the things I think most of us don't really understand is just how incredibly smart most kids are. I say this in a lot of professional development workshops with teachers, is that most kids have never experienced failure until they came to school. They didn't fail to learn to walk. They didn't fail to learn to talk. In fact, they show up in kindergarten having mastered an entire language without the help of a teacher. So we know that that genius is there. So the idea of pairing the notion of hip-hop with genius is to take the culture that matters to kids and take the abilities that they already have. I have colleagues who have been world-renowned for their work in mathematics education, and their work is predicated on the notion that kids are natural problem solvers and that they come to school with their own set of problems, which often school is not willing to help them answer or ask.
We're talking about a pop culture phenomenon here. Looking back over the history of pop culture breakthroughs or things that sort of took popular culture in a different direction, whether it was jazz, whether it was, you know, the Beatles, whatever, it didn't seem as though teachers in the past made allowances for those. So this is sort of breaking away from the norm or traditional education as we know it. What has been the response that you've gotten to this?
Well, I think it varies. It's all over the board. I mean, I think there are some teachers who are so eager to embrace youth culture because they understand it as what's really engaging kids. And I also think there are some teachers who don't want to have anything to do with it. But I want to remind people that some of the stuff that we now call the canon was a part of a popular culture. Shakespeare was popular culture. At the time that Shakespeare's plays were being performed, it was thought as lowbrow. It was like, oh gosh, that's for common people. No, that's not theater. Theater would be Greek theater. So the idea that somehow everything that we have in the canon has always been held in high esteem is not so. So these are teachers who are willing to get ahead of the curve, to try some new things, to connect with kids.
You mentioned today you gave a keynote speech, and you said that we can't create culturally competent students if teachers are culturally incompetent. So how can teachers work toward cultural competence?
First of all, cultural competence is not a destination. It really is about the journey. You're going to always be on this particular journey. My own career has been one that has allowed me to travel to 6 of the 7 continents. The only place I haven't been is Antarctica, and I'm actually not going. But every time I go somewhere, I am blown away by what I'm learning and realizing I've been in the education game now 46 years, and I'm still learning. So somebody's been there 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, needs to know that they have to keep learning. And that's the only way that we can continue to be successful with our kids, if we're willing to keep learning.
Is there a lack of minority teachers in schools? And if so, what can be done to help minority students who may be at a disadvantage?
Clearly, there is an inverse relationship between the students in schools and the people who are teaching them. Most of our students will be taught by white, middle-class, monolingual, female teachers. So all of those categories matter in some fundamental ways, that there are not enough men teaching, and there are clearly not enough people of color who are teaching. But my reasons for wanting a teacher of color in a classroom may be different than what some other people think. In fact, the group that I think most needs to see teachers of color are white children. They need to be in a classroom where they understand that people who are intelligent, who are competent, who are smart, who are capable, come in a variety of backgrounds, races, ethnicities. I don't think there is a one-to-one relationship between a teacher of color and student success. We don't have any empirical evidence to support that. If that were the case, then the best school systems for black children would be in Detroit and Washington, D.C., and we know that's not the case. But we do know empirically that African-American teachers are much more likely to persist with black children. And we've been able to actually document that. But as far as there being some magic racial bullet, that doesn't exist. All of our kids need access to a variety of experiences. As you mentioned, I teach at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and many of my students will tell me, you're the first teacher of color I ever had.
So how can the teaching profession be made more attractive to minorities who are needed in the classroom?
I think we have several problems that are keeping us from recruiting teachers of color. One, of course, is the pipeline issue. If people are not graduating from high school, then the likelihood that they go to college and become teachers is very much compromised. So we have a problem with our high school graduation rates. I think the second problem is probably the success, if you will, of the civil rights movement. The fact that teaching, preaching, and nursing are no longer the only professions that African Americans are relegated to means that I can go to college, I can take a degree in business, and leave college making $75,000 as opposed to making $35,000 as a teacher have made teaching seem a lot less attractive. The prestige of teaching has slipped precipitously over the last generation, and so I think that's really a difficult sell. So I think all of those factors enter into why we have trouble convincing young people of color, young people in general, to choose teaching.
Why has the prestige of teaching diminished? What are the factors involved in that?
There have been a lot of reasons why I think we don't think teachers are as valuable as we, quote, once were. We never rewarded them, so I think we have to be careful about presuming that there were, quote, some good old days. Teachers have always been underpaid, but at least we thought that what they were doing was noble. There is some sociological literature that suggests that there is a relationship in the status of the teachers and the status of who they teach. So as teachers are more likely to be teaching poor kids, as they're more likely to be teaching immigrant kids, as they are more likely to be teaching kids who are minoritized by race or ethnicity, their status is also sinking with those kids. It's sort of like if somebody's teaching advanced placement calculus, they're seen as, quote, more valuable. It shouldn't be that way. If I were somehow magically in charge of remuneration, the people who would be getting all the money would be the kindergarten teachers because they are dealing with an audience that has no compulsion and no desire to stay there, and yet they do marvelous work with very young children.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we're talking today with the keynote speaker for a conference on urban education at Duquesne University, Dr. Gloria Ladson Billings, who is the person who holds the Kellner Family Endowed Professorship in Urban Education and is faculty affiliate in the Departments of Educational Policy Studies and Afro-American Studies at the University of Wisconsin. If a teacher is a good teacher, does their race matter?
No. Some of the teachers, for people who have not read the book I wrote on successful teachers of African-American children, there are 8 teachers that I profile in that book. 3 of those teachers are white. So it isn't about, again, as I said earlier, there's no racial bullet. It is about people's sincere belief in both the ability of the children and their own efficacy as teachers.
And you're not a fan of the term achievement gap. Instead, you prefer the term education debt. Explain the reasoning behind your use of this term.
Okay, I'm going to try to condense this story because I can remember heading home once from a meeting conference, speaking engagement in New York City. And I'm sitting in traffic, as is usual, headed to LaGuardia. And right before you get to the Triborough Bridge, there is a big bulletin board that has these lights that are running like crazy. It's a huge number. And the lights are the number is changing quickly. And above it, the caption says, "This is the national debt." And then underneath it, and there's like $14 trillion, right? But underneath it, there's a smaller number, but it's still a big number. And those lights are moving quickly. And the caption there says, "And this is your share." And I remember thinking to myself, oh, my God, there's no way I'm going to pay that, right? And so I asked myself, Why did I feel compelled to pay that? Well, I think it has to do with the whole narrative we have in the nation about debt. A lot of the discourse coming out of Washington is about how we can't leave our kids with this debt. This is morally wrong for us to do this. We can't, the debt. And I begin to think, you know, we keep saying gap as if we've got a group of kids who are doing great and we've got this other group of kids. We just got to get them to catch up. It's not that simple. And when we talk about it as a gap, we almost always put the responsibility on the children, on their families, and sometimes on their teachers. But when we talk about debt, all of a sudden we have a kind of collective consciousness around debt. We're all worried about the debt. And so I thought it was a good way to begin to really get us to think about how do we get ourselves in this position? We didn't have these academic disparities arise overnight. So I've talked about the debt as something that is historical, that is economic, that is sociopolitical, and is moral. It is historical because we know that there are whole groups of people that we wouldn't even allow to be educated for centuries. In fact, it was illegal to teach African Americans to read. We removed American Indian children from their homes and put them in boarding schools so they could become domestics, and a bunch of them we just didn't educate at all. So we've had this pattern for many, many years or centuries even, where we didn't educate a group. So that's a historical construction of the debt. It's economic because we tend to fund these schools and these communities at different rates. So you can have kids who live in an inner city who have a per capita allocation that is about $10,000 less than their counterparts in the suburbs. And so I've always asked this question, what makes the kids in the suburbs worth $10,000 more than the kids in the inner city? The third piece is that sociopolitical one in which, you know, African Americans in particular did not have full voting rights until 1965. It's not that long ago. So they couldn't even vote for a school board member. They couldn't vote for those people who would govern them. And then the fourth part of the debt, which I can't really talk to you about or prove empirically, is the idea that it is a moral debt. And what I mean by that is some things are just wrong. It is wrong what we have done to whole groups of people, to generations of people for so long. So that's why I've decided that the best way to kind of conceptualize the disparities is to talk about the debt that exists.
Are public schools, in your opinion, still viable? As we've seen things become more equitable within the public school system, we've also seen people leave the system for whatever reasons that they have. And so you're seeing outside of the urban areas, suburban schools being funded differently or at a rate that's not equitable to what public schools are getting. And you hear people say all the time in Pittsburgh that this public high school isn't as good as it used to be, or that public middle school isn't educating kids as well as it used to. What are you seeing? And from a standpoint of looking at the nation as a whole, where are we with public education in America?
Public education is suffering from the same issues that all of the public services are. The quick way for me to talk about it is what I would call an evacuation of the public sphere, where we are pulling back from the public. So if you wanted to go back and look, say, 50 years ago, I grew up in Philadelphia. If you wanted to go anywhere in the city, you took public transportation because it was safe, it was reliable, and it was dependable. Today, nobody wants to ride public transportation. There are only a few viable, high-quality public transportation systems in the country. I lived in California. There was nothing to catch. The buses didn't go where you needed to go. The second thing that was very true 50 years ago is that people were moving into public housing to get out of unsafe places, to get out of places where there wasn't reliable heat. And they went into public housing. It wasn't fancy, but it was safe. And it was the one place you could go and amass a little bit of capital because the rents were not outrageous, so that one day you could indeed buy a home. I got my polio shot vaccine at a public health clinic. So all three of those things, public transportation, public housing, and public health, have seemed to disappear. I see public education as that last little domino, and it is teetering. We have moved into a time in which privatization has become the way of the land. We have no real commitment to the public good unless public goods are going someplace to fund private enterprises.
In 1995, you wrote about the lack of good teaching occurring in the classrooms populated by African-American students. Since then, how have things changed, or how have they not changed?
I think things have actually gotten worse to some degree because we have an entire cadre of teachers who have retired or are retiring. One of the reasons why I wanted to do the study that resulted in the book, The Dream Keepers, is I was fearful that some incredible knowledge and skill was going out the door and no one was documenting it. And I would say that given the lower prestige of teaching, the fact that many teachers have not had raises in 5, 6, 7 years, that we are struggling to have the kinds of teachers that I've talked about. Now, I still find them all the time, go in classrooms across this country, and I see teachers doing amazing things. But for the most part, they're doing them in isolation. They're not being rewarded by the systems in which they work to do these things. They do it because they care. And they're not the norm. They are the exceptions.
I want to thank you so much for joining us. Our guest has been Dr. Gloria Ladson-Billings. She is the keynote speaker at Duquesne's annual conference on urban education, and among her books is The Dream Keepers, Successful Teachers of African American Children. Again, Gloria Ladson-Billings. Dr. Ladson-Billings, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
More Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Today we're talking about the Pittsburgh soundscape, but we don't mean the Yinzer accent or the sounds of cheers at a Pirates game. According to two German acoustics experts who recently performed audio analysis of the Steel City, everyday sounds like road traffic, planes and helicopters, and outdoor music play a major role in shaping how we in Pittsburgh experience our urban spaces. Joining us by phone now from Aachen, Germany, to describe their acoustic analysis of Pittsburgh are Brigitte Schulte-Fortkamp, a professor at the Technical University of Berlin, and Klaus Genoit, a professor at RWTH Aachen University. Welcome to both of you. Guten Tag.
Hello.
Hello. Guten Tag.
Let's begin with you, Brigitte. How do you define a soundscape?
A soundscape is an area that is characterized by a specific sound design, let's say something like this. And the main thing of soundscape is it's considering mainly the perception of sound, how you perceive a sound in a specific area. This is containing the soundscape.
And Klaus, would you explain for our listeners psychoacoustics?
Psychoacoustics describes the perception of sound by human being. The human being has a very complex signal processing, so we are not only looking for the level or energy, but we perceive something like loudness, sharpness, that means high frequencies, roughness, that means the modulation, and so on. The human hearing is very sensitive for any kind of patterns in the time and frequency domain, and this will be covered by the psychoacoustics to analyze sound in context.
Tell us about when you were in Pittsburgh. How did you go about doing your sound analysis?
Okay, we should start with the typical process then of soundscaping. So what we did was we went out into the park. I think it's what was Fort Pitt, and we were simply describing what we perceived in this area. See what we were hearing, most likely, and also what we were seeing. And we were talking about what was our impression. And the next step then, or sometimes also in parallel, we did measurements and psychoacoustic measurements. And So we have two things. When the thing what is first is the perception of the area. You may say this is a nice area, a pleasant area. I like it. I like to go there. It's a green area, and it has, and for this reason, it has to sound like a green area, for instance. But it really did not sound like this. And Klaus did the measurements, and I give it back to Klaus.
Okay, so you were in Point Park, which is as you described, certainly a green area. But you're absorbing a lot of the sounds that you would hear in other parts of the city, I would imagine. So, Klaus, as you go about doing your measurements, what are you using? What kind of apparatus, what kind of equipment do you use to analyze a soundscape?
We have a special small device, a binaural device. That means we can record of the left and the right ear. That has the advantage that we can, after the recording, do some listening tests. We have a real impression of the sound situation. So we can do, on the one side, listening tests with test persons. On the other side, we can analyze the sound with psychoacoustics. So we can analyze the normal spectra to see what kind of frequencies are in the soundscape, what kind of loudness, what kind of sharpness, and other parameters. The advantage now, listening binaurally, that means with the two ears to the original situation, you can select the several sound sources in such a complex soundscape. We have the traffic noise, we have the fountain noise, we have a noise from the big train, we have noise from the from airplanes approaching the airport, and so on. So there's a superposition of a lot of sound sources, and we can select by listening the single sound source and can say, okay, this part is very big, important for the annoyance of the sound, for example, a lot of tire road noise or gearbox noise of bigger trucks and so on.
And so is this like a regular tape recorder and you're then able to go back and separate the sounds?
Yeah, we have developed a special small device. We call it Scobold. It's very small and has additional function that you have the GPS data that we exactly know where we did the recording. We can combine it with video recording so that we have an optical information about the soundscape situation. So it's optimized for these kind of recordings. Listen with two ears, record with two ears, listen to the sound, and exactly know where you are, where was the position, and where you are looking, in which direction.
It seems that there are some unpleasant sounds that Pittsburghers, like many city dwellers, have to deal with, from sirens to construction. You mentioned, Klaus, the trucks, trains. Is noise pollution another way of describing what you're talking about?
So noise pollution is something which is on the same context, content, but it has a different, say, evaluation. You know, when you go with noise pollution, you're usually going with SPL, sound pressure level. You know, this is one thing. And maybe you talk about annoyance and you measure kind of annoyance. But using this approach in soundscaping combined with psychoacoustic measurements does mean you go with, let me say, you go with people's mind about it. So if you, for instance, want to change something in an area to make it more pleasant to everyone, it's very important that you know what people would like to do at this place, what are their wishes, their visions, etc. And for this reason, you need more to know about the soundscape, again, the soundscape, then the noise pollution. The noise pollution is to be measured very easily. You have one number for that, for instance, and then you may know it's loud or not loud. But there are so many in this loudness or in this noise or in this sound which makes it unpleasant or pleasant. So you need some more information. That's the difference.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer, and we are talking about the Pittsburgh soundscape with two German acoustics experts who did an acoustic analysis of Pittsburgh, Brigitte Schulte-Fortkamp, who is a professor at the Technical University of Berlin, and Klaus Genoit, a professor at RWTH Aachen University. We're familiar with the idea that different places have different feels. For instance, beach sounds include seagulls and waves crashing upon the shore, and that can make you feel very relaxed. What kind of feelings would you say Pittsburgh's soundscape evokes or creates?
You know, this is something which is, for some reasons, in some areas, very pleasing and very pleasant. And in some areas, it's really irritating. This is what I think about it, because you have a very nice place, like, for instance, the marketplace, and it sounds really not so nice as it looks because of all these different kind of music at the same time. You cannot really listen to the place itself. So again, to sum it up, it's somehow a nice soundscape, but it's disturbed by different sources. And this kind of sources, they have not to be there, especially if when we could talk about music input.
And so, Brigitte, which of the places you analyzed in Pittsburgh would you say has the best soundscape, and which has the worst or the most unpleasant?
Oh, you know, this is the most difficult question, because, you know, this park, Fort Pitt, has a very nice place to stay and to listen. You know, as soon as you come close to the fountain, for instance, you do not hear the tire noise anymore. You are really enjoying the fountain sound, and you see the green, etc. So this is a very nice place, which I really say that people should go to, and to go in front, you know, to the, very much in front of the fountain, for instance. And, you know, we haven't seen too many places of Pittsburgh, but I would say also there are also places downtown the city, like I mentioned before, the marketplace, which can be very nice also from the whole soundscape impression, if there would not be too much annoyance caused by music.
Yeah, a lot of people do like to be in that area where the fountain is, at the Point, as it's called. Klaus, there are many cities in the United States that you could have gone to do your work. What led you to Pittsburgh?
There was a big conference from the Acoustic Society of America, and both of us, we have present papers there. That was the reason why we were in Pittsburgh.
Yeah, so you happened to be here. You figured you might as well go to work.
Yes.
For decades, Pittsburgh has made great improvements in reducing our industrial pollution. What would you say that we could do here in this city to improve our noise pollution?
Of course, on the one side, we can reduce the tire road noise by improving the pavement of the roads. That's one topic. The other topic is the marketplace, for example. You have a lot of nice restaurants, but every restaurant has loudspeakers with music, but different music, and that is very disturbing. And this marketplace cars can come into this marketplace. It is very disturbing, too. Cars are looking for a parking place and so on. Even if they drive at low speed, it is still disturbing this kind of soundscape. So that is a typical approach, that at nice places you will try to reduce the general traffic. And in Germany, a lot of cities are doing this already, that the center of a city will be forbidden for cars, so that you have only people walking and sitting there. And the other approach is, like in Fort Point, that they have it use a fountain as a very good masker, because the fountain has a similar spectrum like the tire road noise, but is absolutely constant. That means the complete time pattern will be equalized or compensated by the fountain. You have only the feeling there's a nice fountain, and partly traffic noise will be masked by this noise.
Well, hopefully the people who can do something about this are listening. But in the meantime, I want to thank both of you for taking time to join us again all the way from Germany today, from Aachen. We've been talking with Brigitte Scholte-Fortkamp, a professor at the Technical University of Berlin, and Klaus Genoit, a professor at RWTH Aachen University. They recently were in Pittsburgh doing an acoustic analysis of the Pittsburgh soundscape. Brigitte, Klaus, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh. We appreciate it. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Whether you're driving, walking, or biking, transportation issues are a major concern in cities and towns around the world. Finding innovative ways to improve the many modes of transportation and making them safer is a goal of the upcoming Intelligent Transportation Society of America's Expo, taking place next week at the David Lawrence Convention Center. Right now, we're previewing the event with Paul Feenstra, He's Senior Vice President for Government and External Affairs at the Intelligent Transportation Society of America. Paul Feenstra, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you, Paul. It's great to be with you.
You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. The email address is esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. For listeners who might not have heard of the Intelligent Transportation Society of America, Paul, what do you do?
Absolutely. So we are the nation's largest nonprofit association that brings together the transportation and technology communities to help solve problems. So that's everything from improving vehicle and highway safety, reducing traffic congestion, bringing people better traffic and smartphone apps to help reduce travel delays, give people better options. We're all about using technology to help address transportation challenges.
So what kind of technological inroads are you making when it comes to trying to address these transportation challenges?
Sure. So there's a number of really exciting things happening in the transportation technology world. Just a few of those that I'm sure a lot of our viewers are familiar with are connected and automated vehicles, you know, driverless cars, vehicles that are soon going to be communicating with other vehicles and with the nation's infrastructure to be able to prevent crashes, things like advanced traffic management centers and smart traffic signals that will change based on real-time traffic conditions, smartphone apps that give people better information to make decisions, smart sensors and vehicles that can help detect bridge and roadway conditions to be able to prevent tragedies like we've seen in the past in places like Minneapolis, all kinds of cool things, even things like smart parking technologies that will help people find open parking places. There's so much happening right now in the technology world, and we're just beginning to realize a lot of those revolutionary changes in our nation's transportation system. And so that's what we're really excited to be coming to Pittsburgh next week. We actually kick off on Sunday, and we're bringing about 2,000 leaders from the transportation and technology communities from around the country. So that includes state highway officials from a number of different states, senior federal officials from U.S. Department of Transportation, Department of Energy, the White House, Congress. We're bringing technology leaders from places like Google and Uber, smartphone sort of companies like and startup companies like Ride Scout. We're really coming to Pittsburgh because Pittsburgh has become such a hub of innovation, particularly when it comes to addressing transportation challenges. You have such a great local leadership when it comes to universities like Carnegie Mellon, companies like Michael Baker International, as well as local leadership that's been extremely supportive of innovation and of solving transportation challenges, not just on highways, but across the board, biking, pedestrians, transit, and the like. And so we're thrilled to be joining you here starting on Sunday.
Okay, so, I mean, you've given us quite an overview there. A lot of different topics are going to be bandied about, and there are many different directions we could go in here. So you said something just now about, you were talking about the bridge collapse in Minneapolis, and I'm assuming you're referring to what happened 8 years ago at about this time when the I-35 bridge collapsed in Minneapolis.
Absolutely.
Now, you're saying that there is some sort of technology being developed now that could have prevented the tragic death. I think it was about a dozen people that died in that collapse. What is there on the horizon or maybe in existence already that would prevent people from dying in an accident like that?
Sure. Well, some of the technologies that have been deployed over the last number of years are smart sensors that you can actually put in bridges or attach to bridges that will be able to detect any kind of variations in stress levels and be able to actually warn you in advance if there's a problem.
So I'm driving. Let me just put, I'm sure people listening to this and I'm sure people who remember back to when this happened thought, oh my God, what would it be like? What would I be doing if I were in a car and that was happening? So what exactly, let's say an individual is driving, they're on Interstate 35 and they're going west and they're going over that bridge. What is going to happen technologically that's going to either prevent them from going onto the bridge or give them time to get off the bridge or you know, whatever we're talking about here?
Sure. Well, actually, the goal is to be able to recognize when there's a bridge that has potential issues before people are even close to driving on it. So being able to detect bridges like we should have been able to do in Minneapolis and elsewhere that are structurally deficient by using technology to really identify which bridges are at risk and which just need to be upgraded over time.
How does it work?
So tell over time when there are stresses to the bridge, when there are cracks in the bridge that shouldn't be there. One of the really cool things, actually, that Carnegie Mellon University is working on is not just the bridge-based sensors, but actually being able to put sensors in vehicles to detect when there are cracks and stresses on the roadway surface that shouldn't be there. And so not only on vehicles, but actually on your smartphone. And that's something we're seeing a lot more of in this sort of big data environment, is being able to use things like your smartphone, like your vehicle, as a sensor to be able to tell even things like pavement condition. And that's a technology that's just starting to become more widely available that has really exciting potential for not only catching problems in advance, but as you said, even being able to tell sort of in real time what's happening on the transportation system to be able to make changes to, you know, to even avoid things like traffic congestion.
We're talking with Paul Feenstra. He's Senior Vice President for Government and External Affairs at the Intelligent Transportation Society of America. And the ITS of America's Expo is taking place next week at the David Lawrence Convention Center. On Monday, you're welcoming an expert on self-driving cars. This is fascinating concept. How is this coming along? What are we going to hear about next week?
Sure, and he's actually a former Carnegie Mellon alumni as well. Dr. Chris Urmson, who's the head of self-driving cars for Google, is going to be with us. And as I'm sure everybody knows, Google has become a real leader in the self-driving car arena. And he's going to be talking about Google's vision for sort of the next 5 to 10 years, where they see self-driving cars going, what they see the challenges as being, and as well as potential solutions. And so this has been a huge area of focus within the transportation industry, not only by companies like Google and Uber and even Apple, but by the automakers and suppliers themselves, as well as universities like Carnegie Mellon that have really, really been on the forefront in this area. You know, Carnegie Mellon was really one of the leaders back in 2008, I believe, in the DARPA Urban Challenge in developing one of the original driverless cars. And so the technology is there, and I think we're going to see more and more adoption, even before we get to fully driverless cars, of automated features. So things like, you know, automatic cruise control on highways, self-parking technologies, things like that, where people don't necessarily turn the reins over completely to the vehicle, but are able to allow the vehicle to do functions for them that make their lives more convenient. And so I think it's going to be a really exciting few years ahead of us as we watch this evolution toward more automation, more use of big data, more connectivity, not only in our vehicles, but across our transportation system. It's really going to make people's lives better.
And another thing that's happening in the auto industry is the concept of having cars talk to each other in real time to prevent crashes. This sounds fascinating. How does this work?
This is probably the most exciting development in transportation safety that we've seen, you know, since the seatbelts and airbags. Vehicle-to-vehicle communication, according to federal officials, according to USDOT, has the potential to prevent or reduce the impact of up to 80% of unimpaired vehicle crashes just by letting cars talk to each other and talk to the world around them, things like traffic signals, even smartphone apps that will be equipped with this technology to be able to warn pedestrians or warn drivers if there's someone walking out in traffic, if there's a bicycle in your blind spot, if there's a car or a truck that's about to blow an intersection. This will actually be able to warn drivers. And with cars that have automated braking technology, it'll actually be able to allow cars to physically stop themselves from crashing. And this has huge, huge potential for safety. We are very close to deploying this technology. General Motors, their CEO, Mary Barra, announced last year, actually at our event that we hosted, similar to the next week's event, that GM is going to start putting this technology in some of their new model Cadillacs next year, in some of their 2017 models. Companies like Toyota, Ford, and others are also very close behind. Toyota's actually put this technology in their vehicles in Japan already. And so this is coming quickly, and this is really, it's had huge benefits for safety, but it's also an enabling technology for more vehicle automation in the future. Very exciting stuff, and we have some of the senior-most leaders from the U.S. Department of Transportation, as well as from the tech community, who are going to be talking about this and what their visions are for actually deploying this technology.
One of the things that frustrates us here in Pittsburgh is the fact that the traffic lights are not synced up. And one of the things that will be discussed at your expo is smart traffic signals, which, as I mentioned, we don't have it in Pittsburgh. How does it work, and how close are we to seeing most major American cities have this?
Sure. Smart traffic signals are definitely one of the technologies that I think will probably benefit people the most in terms of their daily lives. I know if your listeners are anything like I am, I get really frustrated when I'm sitting in a traffic light, there's nobody coming the other direction, and it's red for 2 or 3 minutes. That's all going to change in the next, in the next several years. And it's already changing in some cities. This is actually another area where Pittsburgh is actually at the forefront, thanks to the work of Carnegie Mellon and the city of Pittsburgh. Carnegie Mellon has been developing they call it SURTRAC. It's an acronym, Scalable Urban Traffic Control, but really it's traffic signals that use artificial intelligence, that use sensors, things like radar and cameras, to be able to change their traffic signal time in real time, and not just at individual signals, but sort of across a corridor. So you go through one light, just get stopped at the next one. It changes all the lights for you based on real-time conditions.
This is beginning
to be deployed. It's actually already at 18 intersections in East Liberty and Bakery Square. And they're looking to increase this network to 50 intersections. And they have already seen, where they've been testing this in East Liberty, they've already seen huge benefits. Travel times have been reduced by 25%, wait times by 40%, and consequently emissions have been reduced by 20%. And so this is beginning to be deployed more broadly. But Pittsburgh's really been at the lead of this. We have a number of cities that have synchronized signals, but having this kind of intelligence built into the traffic signals that can actually respond in real time is just really revolutionary. And particularly as cities get more congested, places like Pittsburgh that don't have a lot of room to expand, we're pretty confined with rivers and with hills, and there's only so many more tunnels and bridges and highways we can build.
Right, that's why
traffic,
Paul, let me jump in.
Traffic network that we have more efficiently is critical.
That's why we have a downtown that's shaped like a triangle, and I'm sure there are plenty of people who would welcome that technology on Grant Street. We have less than a minute left, about 30 seconds. The topography of Pittsburgh is unique and not without its traffic challenges. You've said Pittsburgh is a place where a lot of this testing is going on, and certainly the development is happening with the CMU being involved. Does this make Pittsburgh a good test city for developing traffic technology?
It does, and this is really why we chose Pittsburgh. Pittsburgh both is a huge innovation hub and has really developed innovations that are being looked at worldwide, which is why we have people from across the country coming and across the world really coming to Pittsburgh. But it also has challenges that are unique, but also similar to a number of other cities, a number of other legacy cities that are working to become smart cities, working to use technology better. And so you have a lot of the challenges other cities have, but all sort of wrapped into one, which is probably why a lot of the innovations are being developed in Pittsburgh, because that's what needs to be done to deal with traffic congestion, with safety
Paul,
issues.
Paul, I need to jump in.
With an aging infrastructure.
Well, it sounds fascinating. And again, it's the ITS America's Expo taking place next week at the David Lawrence Convention Center. Paul Feenstra, thank you so much for joining us on Essential Pittsburgh.
Absolutely. We're looking forward to being with you. Thank you.
We're out of time. Have a good weekend. So long for now.